had reached a dead end because of various circumstances and various things that had happened. But briefly, Sayyidina, if you could say something about that,
in the last minute or so, about what we are seeing today.
Why
he's absolutely right is the fact that Shiite opinion did not say that this leadership or the guidance of the ulama is something which is purely in the time of the occultation,
yes,
during the absence of the 12th Imam.
Yeah.
In fact, it's been a process. It's been a process which has successfully developed even in the time of Mawla Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib's time.
Yes, yes.
You know, sometimes people say that the faqih or the jurisprudence has only responsibility in the absence of the imam. But no, in the presence of the imam, a jurist was active. Who was that jurist who was active? When Mawla Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib sent Malik al-Ashtar to Misr, he sent the most prominent scholar of his time.
Exactly.
To go to Misr and extrapolate on the needs of the people on the basis of the fiqh that Amir al-Mu'mineen had taught him.
Well, this is the thing about the beauty of this school of thought, isn't it?
Exactly.
The most knowledgeable, the most competent, the most...
Exactly.
You know, has the expertise to handle these
and
affairs.
And you see, I mean, just as a joke, you know, Imam Ali did not give Malik al-Ashtar a fax machine saying, if you're stuck, give me a fax, I'll give you a fatwa. No, he had the best qualities, the most competent to do that. And that's what we see.
These are people in their own right who can
indeed
do this.
But these individuals do not claim to be Masums.
No, they're not. No.
But they have the recognition of the authority of the Masum to apply over the people.
Exactly, the expertise
is
there.
And this is what Imam Khomeini was trying to articulate in the meaning of the Wilayat al-Faqih.
Thank you very much for that, Sayyidina. That was... that's wonderfully concluded our program today. But we'll carry on with the next session, listeners, to the third phase of this very important revolution. But we'll do that in the next program. But thank you very much for listening today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be upon you all.
The last message of the late Imam.
Oh, you deprived people of the world. Oh, you Muslims and Muslim countries of the world. Rise up and fight for your rights. Do not be afraid of the propaganda batteries of the superpowers and their mercenary agents. Drive out from your lands your wicked rulers who hand over your earnings to your enemies and the enemies of Islam. You yourselves and the dedicated public servants should take charge of the affairs of your country. Gather together, all of you, under the honoring banner of Islam and fight the enemies of Islam and of the deprived people of the world. Advance toward an Islamic sovereign government with so many free and independent republics. If you realize this, the arrogant powers shall retreat to their own places, and all the deprived people will come to inherit the earth and attain guardianship over it, looking forward to the day when Allah's promise shall be fulfilled.
Last year, during the holy month of Ramadan, Saudi Arabia aired a TV series called Harun, starring unprecedentedly Jewish characters. Fans praised the show for highlighting the history of Jewish communities in the Persian Gulf, but critics blasted it as a barefaced attempt to reshape Arab views of Israel to pave the way for formal relations. or what many in the Arab world call normalization. This year, during the month of Ramadan, something more seriously happened to reinforce the pro-Israeli tendency of leading Arab media outlets in Saudi Arabia, above all, Al Arabiya Media Company. The recent escalation between the Israeli regime and the Palestinian people grabbed the headlines across the world. People took to the streets in order to show their solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine, condemning the savagery of Israel's indiscriminate attacks. Against such a backdrop, many observers found it shocking that Riyadh-based TV channel Al Arabiya took an anti-Palestinian gesture, not least because the network reflects the kingdom's official stance towards the Palestinian cause and the occupation issue as a whole. As a result, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine has called on the Palestinian people and the rest of the Arab world to boycott Al Arabiya for its dubious pro-Israeli agendas. The Front has condemned the channel for distorting the realities in the occupied territories, all in favor of the Israeli regime. In a recent communique, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine lashed out at Al Arabiya for broadcasting false things about the Palestinians, such as describing the resistance movement as a terrorist initiative, while picturing the illegal regime and its settlers as the victims. In one of what the Front called a sheer slander, Al Arabiya claimed that the leaders of the resistance movement left Gaza, along with their families, for Egypt, ahead of the all-out war.
I think the story as a whole needs to be looked at historically. Within the Palestinian struggle and the situation there, if you study the media coverage, not just across the Arab world, but across internationally, there are two main strategies that are taking place. One is to dehumanize the Palestinian people, and you see that in the kind of language that's used, and you see that in terms of the comparison of the life and the value of a Palestinian compared to an Israeli, for example. And the second strategy is to basically dehumanize them and to blame the victim. So the dehumanization is very clear in the language, in media, including in the Saudi media that you've seen. And the other aspect, which is the blaming the victim, which is very carefully laid out by Edward Said, the Palestinian writer, where the aggressor becomes the person who's being attacked by the Palestinians, which is clearly not true if you look at it in militarily terms, in political terms, and in human rights terms, of course.
It's not the first time the kingdom-based Al Arabiya is covering the developments in Palestine in favor of the Israelis, but this time it has adopted a more explicit approach. Their guests and experts intentionally blame Hamas for what has happened in recent weeks in Gaza and the rest of the occupied territories, without addressing the root causes of the tensions, such as the attempt to illegally evict some Palestinian families from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem Al-Quds, or attacking Muslim worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy month of Ramadan. At the same time, they underline the effectiveness of Israel's Iron Dome in intercepting Hamas rockets fired from Gaza.
These very relatively small stories are important because the whole language of soft power and hard power is what we're seeing at play here. The soft language that's used and the hard politics that's at play is what undermines the situation of the Palestinian people. And I think it is a question of language. It is a question of preparing the minds of the international community for a situation where there can be some enforced state on the Palestinian people.
This time, the Saudi leading media refrained from paying even lip service to sending a clear signal to both the Palestinian people and the Israeli regime. Whereas Al Arabiya didn't interview a resistance movement official during the escalation, the channel talked on several occasions to the Israeli regime's military spokesman, Avichai, providing him with the opportunity to justify Tel Aviv's war crimes. By the same token, Emirati leading media outlets relied heavily on the style and content of Western wire services. An editorial in El Ittihad was entitled "No to Violence and Hate." It featured lukewarm calls for an end to tensions in East Jerusalem al-Quds and took issue with practices which violate the sanctity of Al-Aqsa mosques. No doubt the piece was in line with the UAE's current stance on Israel, following the normalization agreement signed between the two last year.
Well, I think we have to be careful when we use the word normalization, because actually normalization, from the point of view of the aggressor, is the suppression of the normal. This normalization, which the Americans are trying to push through, is actually violence, it's actually aggression. And so that's why the Palestinian people have no choice but to resist this so-called normalization. Normalization to the people of Palestine would mean the freedom of Palestine. Normalization to the people of Palestine would be the right to their own land, the right of return, the right of the return of refugees, the right to eat, the right to drive, the right to work, the right to sleep without the threat of bombardment. So this is normalization from the point of view of the Palestinians. And I think language, again, is very important in terms of the press, in terms of media. I think that we have to be very careful of this phrase, normalization, because on the face value, it seems very acceptable. You know, who wouldn't want things to be normal? But normal for who? And who determines what's normal?
Meanwhile, Sharjah-based broadsheet Al-Khalij framed Israeli strikes in Gaza, which have killed dozens of people, including children, a response to rocket fire by Palestinian factions from the besieged coastal strip, echoing what the Israeli regime has said while justifying its war crimes. It's a while the Saudi media have softened their tone when covering developments in the occupied territories. The tightly controlled media in Saudi Arabia clearly reflect the attitude of the ruling family in the kingdom towards the Palestinian cause. While the kingdom has not officially normalized ties with the Israeli regime, it has made it clear over and over again that establishing formal ties with Tel Aviv is no longer a taboo subject in a country that claims to be a leading supporter of the Palestinians.
Well, I think the strategy of some of the Arab media, which is controlled by the different countries, whether you're talking about Saudi Arabia or UAE or any of those states, is to put across the point of view, the political point of view and the political demand of the governments of those countries. And we all know that there's been a move by the United States over the past 10 years to try and normalize relationships between some Arab countries and Israel in order to embed the Israeli state in a much firmer way within the Middle East. So that's the geopolitics that's happening here.
The disappointing covering of the recent developments in the occupied territories by Saudi and Emirati media outlets is part of a bigger picture where Palestine is no longer in the fore.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The re-election of Dr. Bashar al-Assad as president for the fourth consecutive time since 2000 is indeed a vote of the Syrian people for the unity of the country and its independence from both Western hegemony and subordination to the ruthless and unelected Arab regimes. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading, President Assad's Re-election Boosts Syria's Independence. Stay tuned for more. The re-election of Dr. Bashar al-Assad as president for the fourth consecutive time since 2000 is indeed a vote of the Syrian people for the unity of the country and its independence from both Western hegemony and subordination to the ruthless and unelected Arab regimes. The result of the election, if it set off celebrations throughout Syria with jubilant people taking to the streets in an atmosphere of rejoicing in a country which for the past decade has been under the relentless attacks of terrorists of all hue and color, it brought utterances of dismay from most Western capitals, including Washington, London, Paris, and Berlin, whose regimes have miserably failed in their bid to destabilize Syria and plant a client clique in Damascus. It was but natural for the tried and trusted friends of the Syrian people, such as Iran, Russia, China, and Lebanon, to congratulate the ophthalmologist whose foresight in choosing the right partners has seen the country safely through a grave crisis and is now keenly eyeing reconstruction, as is evident by the campaign slogan of Hope Through Work. The fact that 14 million people, or 78% of the electorate, turned out to cast ballots for the candidates of their choice, with the incumbents garnering 95% of the votes, is a proof of the aspirations of the Syrian people and a firm slap on the face of the U.S. and other enemies of President Assad, including the illegal Zionist entity. Just a sizable Christian minority which has no trust in the pro-terrorist policies of the U.S. and Europe, the Sunni Muslim majority of Syria, including the army, know very well that their freedom, dignity, and stability of the country are indebted to the strong and independent political leadership of the Assad family, the late Hafez, and the incumbent Dr. Bashar. They have not forgotten how France, during its League of Nations mandate, between the two world wars had separated Lebanon and in 1937 handed over Iskenderun and what is now Hatay province to Turkey. They remember the rise and fall of over a dozen governments in Damascus since 1946, within a period of only 24 years, before the emergence in 1970 of the Alawite statesman, Air Force Chief and Defense Minister Hafez al-Assad, to grant stability to the country, which 3 years earlier in 1967 had lost the Golan Heights to the Israeli regime. In other words, whatever Syria has achieved as a strong frontline state against the usurpation of Palestine and has weathered a decade-long terrorist conspiracy to balkanize the country is because of the now 51-year-long rule of the Assads, father and son, who have always favored the unity of the whole Levant, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Palestine, into a solid bloc in view of the common culture, history, and the Arabic dialect of the region. This is what alarms the West and the U.S. in pursuit of its hegemonic policy to keep the Levant divided and to strengthen the illegal Zionist entity. They had hatched the destabilization plus in 2011, which has now clearly failed. Now, with government forces poised for mop-up operations in Idlib and the other occupied enclaves, the re-election of President Bashar al-Assad for another seven-year term will certainly help the Syrian people in rebuilding the country and ensuring its independence.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are still reeling from the most recent Israeli onslaught against the coastal territory. Such scenes of destruction are seen throughout Gaza, with many families camping near their flattened homes. It could take many months before these ruined buildings are rebuilt. Israel's devastating onslaught left scores of Palestinians, including dozens of children, dead. The war was another stark reminder of how brutal the regime can be in dealing with the people it has subjugated for many decades. The Israelis argued during the operation that they were trying to wipe out resistance groups and their capabilities. But that's implausible because the sheer number of civilian casualties and horrific scenes of destruction of residential buildings leave no doubt that the regime committed numerous crimes and violations during its latest war. On Thursday, the United Nations Human Rights Council voted to launch an international investigation into the war. The draft resolution was presented by Pakistan on behalf of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the Palestinian delegation to the United Nations. Pakistan's ambassador to the OIC, Khalil Hashmi, who was speaking on behalf of the organization, sharply criticized Israel's supporters. He blasted Israel's allies for shielding the occupier from global accountability and providing arms and ammunition for its widely reported war crimes and crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people. United Nations Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet had tough words for Israel. She rejected Israeli claims that the destroyed buildings in Gaza were hosting members of the Palestinian resistance groups or used for military purposes. Meanwhile, the UN rights chief also criticized Hamas for firing rockets at Israeli cities, saying it constituted, quote, a clear violation of international humanitarian law. Thursday's announcement of an international investigation into alleged crimes committed during the 11-day war seems to have enraged the Israelis. The regime was quick to reject the decision, saying it would not cooperate with the probe. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, on the other hand, welcomed the investigation. The United States, which has observer status and no vote at the Geneva Forum, refrained from speaking at the special session. The investigators will have a broad mandate to look into all alleged violations. The probe will cover not just the Gaza Strip, but also the occupied West Bank and the Israeli cities, which came under retaliatory rocket attacks by Palestinian resistance groups. Future findings of the independent investigation are expected to once again mount pressure on the Israeli regime. But will its allies allow any meaningful action against it? The U.S. in particular has been extremely supportive of Tel Aviv. Observers believe this unwavering support leaves no room for the U.S. to want to be a mediator between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Obviously, for people in Palestine, for many, many countries in the world, the notion of the United States being a mediator is simply a derisory. It's a joke, and nobody believes it. But for internal domestic consumption, that's important. It also is a fig leaf for Europeans, particularly the British, but others, to say, well, the United States is in charge, and we don't have to do anything. But I think increasingly, and we see that, increasingly the United States is no longer considered to be a mediator. The Palestinians, for sure, cannot continue to do this. Abbas cannot continue to agree to these things, and that's obvious.
Tensions between Russia and the U.S. are on the rise over the START Treaty. Russia has accused the U.S. of failing to stick to its obligations under the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, known as the START Arms Control Treaty. Moscow has accused Washington of exceeding the agreed limit on the number of American launchers and bombers. Moscow says 56 U.S. launchers and 41 heavy bombers had been removed from Washington's declared arsenal.
Well, both countries are playing this game. We know that they have enough capabilities to destroy each other and the whole world. But, we can understand human desire to gain the dominance. So I'm sure that both Russia and United States are working, trying to find maybe new ways of, fighting and so on. However, I mean, the idea is that they have to make an agreement and have to stick with it to avoid this crazy situation.
Moscow says that it is unable to confirm that they are no longer nuclear capable. Russia also says four underground missile silos had been removed from the count. According to the calculation provided by the Russian army, the U.S. has exceeded the figure allowed under the treaty by 101.
So far, the START agreement worked, but we do know that the people in Pentagon always, dream of winning nuclear war. At least Russians understand that we need to have parity. Nobody will win the war. That's why we shouldn't start. But I can imagine there are some people are trying to do that. But mostly it is a game of accusations, which, more or less calls for both sides to sit at the table of negotiations and negotiate with each other further.
Washington has rejected Moscow's claim, saying that the U.S. is in full compliance with the treaty obligations. Russia has in the past raised similar concerns over Washington's violation of the Strategic Arms Control Treaty. The new START represents the last major treaty binding the U.S. and Russian nuclear arsenals. The agreement was negotiated by the Obama administration and caps the number of deployed nuclear warheads each country can have at 1,550 apiece. It also allows the two states to have no more than 700 deployed missiles and bombers.
The situation is not particularly promising, but what we have to realize, like as we learned within a couple of hours ago, that finally the two leaders agreed to meet in Geneva on June, I think, 16. So I think, what I would say that Biden's bite is more than that he can chew, that the United States build their policy on this very negative rhetoric against Russia.
Russia had long called for extending the treaty. It is set to expire on February 5. The administration of ex-U.S. President Donald Trump only entered talks on the matter last year and conditioned the extension on a list of demands. New START is the last remaining non-proliferation deal between Russia and the U.S., after the intermediate-range nuclear forces treaty with INF, another key arms control treaty that expired in August 2019. Russia has already announced that it was leaving the treaty on open skies, which allows reconnaissance flights over the participants' entire territory, months after the U.S. under Trump unilaterally quit the key trust-building pact. Back in 2020, the U.S. announced the deployment of a new long-range nuclear missile aboard its stealth submarines to deter what it calls Washington's potential adversaries. The 2019 Congressional Budget Office report showed that Washington seeks to boost its nuclear capabilities, estimating that it will spend some $500 billion on nuclear weapons from 2019 through 2028.
Polls in Syria presidential election closed on Wednesday at midnight after authorities extended voting by 5 hours due to the high turnout. A week earlier, Syrian refugees and expatriates across the world voted in their country's embassies. More than 12,000 polling centers across Syria received the voters. According to the Interior Ministry, a total of 18 million Syrians at home and abroad were eligible to vote in the election. Incumbent Bashar al-Assad is expected to win a fourth seven-year term in office in a contest with a former state minister, Abdullah Saloum Abdullah, and an opposition figure, Mahmoud Mari. Assad enjoys widespread popularity across the country. In 2014, he secured almost 89% of the votes on a turnout of over 73%. After he cast his vote at a polling station in the city of Duma near Damascus, Assad told reporters that the Western opinions about the validity of the ongoing election process in his country have zero value.
The mobilization that we have seen in recent weeks was a clear response, and it says to them, your opinions have zero value, and you are worth 10 times less.
Assad made the comments after the United States, Britain, France, Germany, and Italy claimed that Syria's presidential vote is neither free nor fair. In a joint statement, the foreign ministers of the Western countries also called the vote fraudulent and that it does not represent any progress toward a political settlement. However, Damascus says the election is a sovereign Syrian affair, and that only Syrians have the final word in the matter. Results are due to be announced by Friday evening.
Well, the big thing it teaches us is that an organized resistance of the whole people is able to push back U.S. imperialism, its determination to destroy Syria. This election is a big, big step in asserting their sovereignty and asserting their right to choose their own leadership. And I think that's why there's so much enthusiasm in Syria for this momentous day.
Since the beginning of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple Assad's government, Syria is experiencing a protracted political and socio-economical crisis that has caused a severe deterioration of living conditions. Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple President Assad. After failing to oust the Syrian government through proxies and direct involvement, the U.S. government stepped up its economic war on Syria by imposing crippling sanctions. The sanctions have severely hit the war-torn country's economy by prohibiting foreign companies from trading with Damascus. Meanwhile, the U.S. and European countries have banned export and investment in Syria, as well as transactions involving oil and hydrocarbon products. Also, smuggling of strategic Syrian resources is another tactic used to put pressure on the Syrian government. The government says the Israeli regime and its Western and regional allies are aiding Daesh Takfiri terrorist groups wreaking havoc in the country. Nevertheless, the Syrian government has proved effective as Syrians continue to recapture key areas from remnants of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group and other foreign-backed terrorist factions across the country. But the presence of U.S. and European forces, in addition to Turkish troops, has slowed down the advances.
Well, from the very beginning, the U.S. hasn't wanted the Syrian people to decide anything, wanted to decide for them. And it's not only in parts of Syria, but Syrians around the world.
10 years of foreign-sponsored war in Syria has left more than 380,000 people dead. The UN says nearly 12,000 children have been killed or wounded so far. More than half of Syria's pre-war population of 22 million have fled their homes. Syria is in dire need of help, but surely the West has so far offered nothing but destruction and death to Syrians.
Palestinians have poured to the streets to celebrate their victory over Israel in the 11-day fighting between the two sides. Rallies were held across the besieged Gaza Strip in condemnation of the Israeli regime and celebration of its defeat. Gatherings were also held in the occupied West Bank, where joyful participants cheered for the victory for the resistance. The celebrations came after an Egypt-brokered ceasefire went into effect on Friday morning, ending the fiercest battle there in years. This wasn't the first time the besieged territory came under Israeli fire, but this time, Palestinians turned the tables against the regime and launched unprecedented rocket and drone attacks on Israeli cities, inflicting damage and casualties on the enemy. Experts believe that Israel has succumbed to the unprecedented response by the Palestinian resistance and agreed to the ceasefire without any preconditions.
I think it's a huge win. The fact is that never before have we seen Israel penetrated militarily, psychologically, and morally in this way before. The sheer numbers of Palestinian resistance missiles that actually penetrated the Iron Dome is absolutely incredible. This much-vaunted dome, which was meant to protect the Israeli civilians, essentially collapsed, because my estimation is around 30% of the missiles got through. And what were these missiles? Essentially, they were just homemade rockets. Not only that, what we've seen is that this, for the first time, turned into an insurrection within occupied Palestinian territory. Within the colony itself, they call Israel, you saw huge numbers of Palestinians demonstrating and rising up, and actually huge clashes took place. A lot of that would have been suppressed.
People across the world have shown their solidarity with Palestinians in the past few days. In the United States, protesters called for the cessation of all funding to Israel. As the Israeli regime was targeting the people of Palestine, the U.S. administration approved the sale of $735 million in precision-guided weapons to the Israeli regime. The arms deal is now pending the approval of Congress. Several American congresspeople, including Senator Bernie Sanders and House Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Mark Pocan, and Rashida Tlaib, objected to the plan and introduced motions to block the sales. But given the traditionally strong support for Israel in the Congress, the motions will almost certainly fail.
The U.S. is totally $3.5 billion per annum is donated by Israel to by America to Israel in order to sustain its arms industry. As the bombs were falling on Palestinian children, you found that Joe Biden cleared $750 million of aid for arms and missiles to Israel. So that was the initial response of America.
In the meantime, U.S. President Joe Biden has welcomed the ceasefire, expressing hope that it would hold. He, however, reaffirmed the U.S. support for the Israeli regime. Several Israeli political and military figures have questioned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's motives for launching the offensive on the Gaza Strip and approving a ceasefire without any strategic breakthrough for the regime. Netanyahu's political opponents speculate that the premier ordered the strikes after he failed to establish a coalition cabinet to put an end to Israel's political stalemate. But the developments over the past 2 weeks have shown that the next time the regime ventures an offensive against Gaza, it could face consequences more serious than a political vacuum in Tel Aviv.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. The world's leading insurance companies, especially U.S. ones, are underwriting and investing in industries that drive planetary heating, destroy ecosystems, and violate human rights. According to Insuring Disaster, a new report released recently by a United Kingdom-based financial industry watchdog. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. Insurance Giants, Worsening Climate Crisis, Biodiversity Loss, and Human Rights Violations. Stay tuned for more. Leading insurance companies, especially U.S. ones, are underwriting and investing in industries that drive planetary heating, destroy ecosystems, and violate human rights, according to Insuring Disaster, a new report released recently by a United Kingdom-based financial industry watchdog. In what it described as the first comprehensive assessment of insurers' environmental, social, and corporate governance, ESG credentials, Share Action analyzed and ranked how 70 of the world's biggest insurance companies, together responsible for assets totaling $22 trillion, are approaching responsible investment governance, the climate emergency, biodiversity loss, and human rights. In contrast to their reputation as risk experts who assesses, manages, and help reduce social and environmental risks, the majority of large insurers fail to adequately address systematic risks such as climate change and biodiversity loss, wrote the authors of the report, which was based on company surveys and an examination of publicly available data. Almost half of insurers, that is about 46%, received an E, the lowest grade, while another 17% received a D rating. Just 16% demonstrated a relatively strong performance that merited a rating of B or higher. Yet, even the leading insurer scored just over 50% of the available points, the report said. On average, insurers scored only 12% of all available points. We hope this unprecedented overview of the industry offers a wake-up call to insurers, report co-author Felix Nagrawala said in a statement. These ratings must improve and quickly if the industry hopes to survive a future built on renewables and equity, not fossil fuels and slave labor. No insurer received an AA or AAA rating, although five European companies received an A grade. The performance of U.S. insurers, meanwhile, was remarkably poor. ShareAction gave an E to 75% of U.S. insurance companies, compared with 52% in Asia and 22% in Europe. Of the 12 lowest-ranked insurers with a property and casualty business, half were U.S. insurance giants Nationwide, AIG, Allstate, Genworth Financial, Protective Life, and Travelers that scored 5% or lower on issues of governance, climate, biodiversity, and human rights. Furthermore, of the 15 lowest-ranked life and health insurers, which scored 3% or lower on the four categories being evaluated, nine were U.S. companies. RiverSource, Northwestern Mutual, Talcott Resolution, Pacific Life, Lincoln Financial Group, Protective Life, Mass Mutual, Brighthouse Financial, and Aflac. The U.S. insurance industry is buying its head in the sand as the rest of the world races to embrace a greener, cleaner, and more equitable future, said Nagrawala. Despite the sector's expertise in identifying, forecasting, and managing risk, it continues to support companies responsible for climate change, including those engaged in coal, tar, sands, and Arctic oil and gas. These aggregated results from this study showed that while the world's top insurers received an average score of 27% on the topic of governance, they performed even worse on the climate crisis, 11%, human rights, 8%, and biodiversity, about 3%. By continuing to underwrite and invest in fossil fuel extraction and disregard the well-being of working people, by neglecting dangerous workplace conditions, gender and racial discrimination, child and forced labor in supply chains, and forced displacement of communities, insurance companies, particularly U.S. ones, are exacerbating environmental and social crises even more than other actors in the financial sector. The stronger ESG policies and practices, the report said. Despite the fact that insurers make up 12 of the 26 members of the United Nations convened Net Zero Asset Owners Alliance, and despite plans for a Net Zero Insurance Alliance, only 13% of assessed insurers have made net zero commitments for investments, and just 3% have a net zero policy for underwriting activities, according to ShareAction. Insurers are better placed than any other type of private financial institution to exert pressure on the coal industry, as coal projects cannot be financed, built, or operated without insurance coverage, the report noted. but U.S. providers are largely failing to use this influence. In fact, of the 7 assessed U.S. insurance companies with a property and casualty business, Liberty Mutual is the only one with a policy that restricts underwriting for coal projects, ShareAction pointed out. By contrast, 54% of non-U.S. insurers impose restrictions on underwriting for coal projects. However, ShareAction said that none of the 70 companies receiving scrutiny has placed limits on underwriting for gas and oil, despite a 2018 warning from UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that building new fossil fuel projects and keeping global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius are incompatible. The analysis of the global insurance industry comes on the heels of a bombshell report published last week by the International Energy Agency, in which the relatively conservative institution made clear that remaining fossil fuels must stay in the ground if the world is to avert the most catastrophic effects of the climate emergency. Regarding biodiversity loss, the vast majority of assessed insurers have not yet developed an approach to managing nature-related risks to their portfolios and show little understanding of how their investment and underwriting activities are driving or may be affected by the biodiversity crisis, the report noted. Moreover, nearly three-quarters of assessed insurance companies, that is about 73%, do not have an investment policy covering human and labor rights, ShareAction found. Only 13% of assessed insurers have made a commitment not to invest in companies that are knowingly in breach of human and labor rights, showing that the industry is willing to turn a blind eye to direct and deliberate corporate human rights violations, the authors wrote. North American insurers are the worst offenders. Not a single one of the 24 insurers from the U.S. or Canada has a policy. Underscoring the need for the insurance industry to evolve, the report noted that only one of the 7 assessed U.S. insurers with a property and casualty business has carried out climate scenario analysis to identify long-term risks to their portfolios, compared with 46% of non-U.S. peers. ShareAction called that particularly alarming in the context of recent wildfires in the U.S., which in California in 2020 alone caused insured losses of an estimated $8 billion.
As Israel enters its second week of indiscriminate bombings, hundreds of Palestinians have been martyred and many more wounded, with figures climbing into the thousands of injured. The collective mainstream media and Western governments have attempted to portray the onslaught as a mere crisis and to provide cover for Israel's crimes. On this program, we seek to expose those crimes and report the real story that Israel doesn't want you to see. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On May 10th, 2021, Israel began an offensive against the Gaza Strip, bombing the Palestinian enclave by land and by air. For several weeks prior, tensions were growing rapidly in occupied Palestine as Israeli forces cracked down on Palestinian protesters. The protests first began at Damascus Gate in Jerusalem as a result of restrictions that Israel had imposed on Palestinians during the holy month of Ramadan, as well as Israel's plans to evict Palestinian families living in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Earlier that day, on May 10th, Israeli forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque, firing tear gas and rubber-coated bullets at Palestinians while they were inside praying, leaving over 90 people injured. Israel's desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the third holiest site in Islam, drew widespread condemnation and rebuke from Muslims and non-Muslims alike. As a result, the Palestinian resistance group, Hamas, which is also in power in the Gaza Strip, issued an ultimatum demanding that Israel immediately withdraw from Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israel ignored this, and Hamas responded shortly thereafter with rocket fire. Israel then began an offensive against Gaza, launching several airstrikes which have continued every day since May 10th. Thousands of Israeli reservists were called up, and there was a genuine fear that a ground invasion was about to take place. Just like in previous wars against Gaza in 2009 and 2014, Israel has been purposely targeting public and health infrastructure in Palestine. This is a war crime under the Geneva Convention. As a result of Israel's bombings, the only salination plant in the Gaza Strip has been put out of action. The only clinic that is able to carry out COVID-19 tests has also been damaged. 6 out of 10 electricity lines have been cut. As if the electricity situation wasn't already bad enough to begin with, people living in Gaza can get barely 4 to 5 hours of power a day. According to the Palestinian Water Authority, water supplies in Gaza have now been reduced by 40% as a result of the Israeli bombardments. Gaza's water infrastructure has been hit so severely that human waste and sewage are now overflowing onto the streets. Israel has also bombed the main roads that lead to Al-Shifa Hospital, making it more difficult for the wounded to reach the biggest hospital in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry reported that one of its clinics was put out of action. Doctors Without Borders also reported damage to their clinic, and there are photographs all over Gaza of roads completely decimated. Health workers and residents alike describe horrific scenes of seeing loved ones and neighbors buried alive under the rubble, of digging out the deceased from underneath twisted metal and slabs of concrete. The result of Israeli warplanes indiscriminately bombing Gaza. A nurse at Al-Shifa Hospital told Al Jazeera that she had, quote, never seen anything like this in her life. There were body parts collected on hospital beds and unbearable scenes. On May 15th, an Israeli airstrike hit the offices of the Associated Press and Al Jazeera in Gaza. There were no deaths or injuries. However, despite several pleas from the Associated Press for Israel not to bomb the building and to allow them to gather belongings, they were ignored. And the entire 12-story building was leveled by Israeli warplanes as the entire world watched it collapse into rubble. Israel is openly bombing the buildings of some of the largest news outlets on the planet, and the so-called liberal democracies of the West say nothing and shrug it off like nothing happened. Videos have been pouring out of Gaza, one after the other, showing entire residential buildings collapsing under Israeli bombs. Within the first week, the number of deaths on the Israeli side has amounted to 10 people. On the Palestinian side, hundreds have been killed and thousands more have been injured. The majority of them are civilians, not Hamas. In the first week alone, Israel killed over 212 Palestinians. 61 of them were children. That's almost one-third of the casualties. I repeat, almost one-third of the casualties are children. The Gaza Health Ministry reports that over 1,400 Palestinians have been wounded. The UN says that over 40,000 Palestinians have been displaced and over 2,000 have lost their homes. And just to give you another idea of the level of cruelty and barbarism enacted by the Israelis, in the same week, multiple Palestinian families were wiped out entirely by Israeli bombs. On Friday, May 14th, the entire Tanani family in northern Gaza was killed by an Israeli airstrike, which completely flattened their home. The next day, on May 15th, 10 family members of the Al-Hadidi family were killed by an Israeli airstrike on the Shati refugee camp in Gaza. And this is always the case. Every single time Israel attacks Gaza, the death toll is incomparable. The number of casualties is always so much higher on the Palestinian side. The Israelis have an air force, they have a navy, they have drones, they receive billions in military aid every single year from the U.S. This is asymmetrical warfare at best, and it's a bloodbath at worst. Joining me is Dina Al-Muti. She's a trauma-informed clinician and has written extensively for Electronic Intifada. Thanks for coming on. It's a privilege to have you, Dina.
The honor is mine. The honor is mine.
Right now in Gaza, almost one-third of the casualties are children. And we talk a lot about the killed and the wounded, which is horrific in of itself, but what kind of effect does this violence have on the children who survive?